Thank you. Okay, we have Mr. Gerland and we are waiting for Mr. Fluor. And now we have Mr. Fluor. And I will call the case. 2029-49, United States versus Sultan Issa. And Mr. Gerland, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Michael Gerland, on behalf of the appellant, Sultan Issa. I think everyone on this call has a common interest in ensuring that what happened in the district court with regard to the admission of a sentencing memorandum from a third party and facts coming in sideways, I think everyone has an interest in assuring that that doesn't happen again.
Actually, that's a pretty presumptuous comment, Mr. Gerland. I don't necessarily agree with that. And given the Crime Victims' Rights Act, I have trouble seeing where you find a prohibition.
Well, I don't believe that what the Crime Victim Rights Act says, Your Honor, is that a victim has a right to be, quote unquote, reasonably heard at a sentencing or at other hearings or proceedings. Where they may have an interest. What happened here went beyond that and resulted in a due process violation. I could not find a single case that said that a lawyer for a victim could file a sentencing memorandum, make legal arguments, in fact, argue for something inconsistent with what the prosecution and the defense had agreed to.
Isn't that the whole point of the CVRA? To allow victims to provide a different point of view?
The point of the CVRA, as well as Rule 32, is to allow victims to be heard and to present facts that will enable the court to consider the psychological, social, and financial impact of the crime on them in determining sentence. It does not permit victims to put in so-called other relevant conduct about which they have no personal knowledge, about which they have no basis.
Clearly there are limits, and I don't disagree with you about due process, but you've been taking a much, much stronger position in this case that expressing a different view on guideline issues, whether in writing or orally, recommending a different sentence, either violates the due process clause or in your reply brief violates the act.
Well, two responses. I do believe that it went beyond the act. And the courts have been very
expansive. Doesn't impose any limits, does it? I mean, it gives the district judge an awful lot of discretion, reasonably heard.
And I submit what happened here was not reasonable. And the proof of that, Your Honor, is in the fact that after the victim's lawyer told the judge that Mr. Issa began committing crimes in 2008, 2 years before the offense conduct, 2 years before any criminal conduct the government was aware to or would agree to, he walked into state court and filed a verified complaint attesting to the fact that what he had told the judge was false. He told a million-dollar lie to the judge. And it is clear under the...
As to the reliance on the victim's statements, I thought it was pretty clear that the court relied only on the statements as to the close relationship between Mr. Issa and the Westons, and found that it was those facts that made the offense in this case an unusually a personal one. So, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, what error there is in the court relying on those it indisputed, or I should say undisputed facts. I mean, and just as Judge Hamilton noted, isn't that the type of evidence that the court typically would consider in a victim impact statement?
It is, but this went beyond the victim impact statement, Your Honor, and it cannot be disputed. Listen, it's very clear under the law that a due process violation occurs if the court bases its sentencing on unfounded facts, on misinformation, false information, or speculation. And it can't be disputed that the court was misled. They were misled about defendant Issa supposedly forging a release in 2008 on a $2.7 million loan. That never happened. The judge was misinformed. It never happened. And we don't know, sitting here, if the judge considered that or not. The government in its brief says, no, the court can look back and consider this other so-called relevant conduct. And there is no question on the record before this court that a false statement was made to the judge and that it somehow polluted, impacted the hearing. And the judge said more than she was affected by the naming of the children and what Your Honor spoke on. She also said that she found the information provided by Mr. Gehr helpful, informative, without making any findings of fact or any directed decisions. So we don't know, sitting here, and I think it'd be intellectually dishonest to say we know for certain what she did or didn't do. We don't know what she considered with regard to the 2008 conduct that she was told about that never occurred, or 2017 conduct that she was told about that never occurred. And on that record, and I see I'm past my direct time, and I do want to keep some time for rebuttal, but I also want to point out that this court, in 2012, in the Larinetta decision, foresaw this problem and said very clearly, and I'm quoting Larinetta, it's 700 F3rd 983, that would be a quote-unquote mistake, a quote-unquote recipe for chaos, to allow a victim to intervene in a case essentially in the manner that occurred here. The court said, try to imagine if, quote, a non-party tried to participate in the sentencing hearing in order to persuade the judge to impose a harsher sentence than suggested by the prosecutor, close quote. Defendant Issa doesn't need to imagine it. It's exactly what happened to him.
But why is that inconsistent with the Crime Victims Rights Act? Because I understand what Larinetta said, but I find it very difficult to reconcile with statute.
And all the Crime Victims Rights Act says, Your Honor, is that the victim has a right to be, quote unquote, reasonably heard. And I guess the issue is, what is reasonable? And the courts have been very expansive in allowing victims to say and do things. And I submit that here, you know, there has to be a line somewhere. Reasonable doesn't mean anything and everything a victim wants to do. It doesn't mean that a victim can come before and provide false information, which is what happened in this case. It's why there's a due process violation. A line has to be drawn somewhere, and I submit the line was clearly crossed in this case. I'd like to reserve my remaining 2 minutes, if possible, for a book.
Of course. Mr. Fleur.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The district court did not commit error in imposing a below-guideline sentence. Without meaningful objection from the defendant as to the procedure that the district court applied, there was information that was submitted by victims, and it was consistent with the Crime Victims' Rights Act, as well as other statutory law and judicial precedent. The Westons were provided a fulsome opportunity to be heard, but they were not formal interveners, which was what this court was concerned about in the Larinetta case, and that's what they were considering in that case. In this instance, there was no due process concern because the defendant had ample notice to respond to the matters that were presented by the victims, both in writing and in person. And the defendant had ample opportunity to present arguments in opposition of what the victims were asking for.
For the vulnerable victim, is it enough that the defendant know of the victim and the vulnerability, or is something more required, Mr. Fleur?
Yes, Your Honor. The requirements of the applicable guideline are that that the defendant knew or should have known that the victim of his offense was a vulnerable victim. So there's essentially two components. The first being that the victim in question was a victim in the sense that they sustained a loss. The second component is that victim is vulnerable. As there is no targeting requirement that they were specifically targeted because of the vulnerability. I don't think that there's any face-to-face requirement that is, as the defendant has intimated in his papers. In this, what the guideline requires is that the defendant knew of the vulnerability and that there was a loss. And here, both with respect, and I would point out that this was not preserved at the, during the proceedings, and it's our position that the argument is waived through a number of steps, which I'll address in a moment. But as to at least two victims, there was a clear basis in the record, clear vulnerabilities that the defendant acknowledged, both with respect to Dawn Weston, the principal victim's mother. She was in her 90s. She suffered from dementia, and that was her vulnerability. In addition, the loss that she sustained, there's no question as to a trust that had been created for her and to provide for her assisted living expenses. That was raided. That was the term the district court used when summarizing that particular enhancement. In addition to Dawn Weston, though, there's also Grace Castillo, a woman whose husband was a close friend of the defendant and whose husband passed away. And in the months and that followed, the defendant pursued her and encouraged her to invest with him approximately $500,000. He stated that he was going to take a look at her financial situation, and after doing so, he warned her that she would run out of money within 2 years. That was addressed, both victims were addressed in the factual basis to the plea agreement. Both victims, the facts and circumstances were addressed at the sentencing hearing. And at every stage of the proceedings, the defendant did not object and in fact agreed to those to the application of the enhancement in the text of the plea agreement. Yes, Your Honor.
The court didn't rely on Mrs. Castillo in imposing the vulnerable victim enhancement, but did you argue to the court that the enhancement was appropriate on that basis as well?
Your Honor, again, there was no objection, and this was an agreed situation. So what I'd like, and in candor, we, in the sentencing memorandum that the government submitted, we did focus on Dawn Weston, not Grace Castillo. What I would refer the court to is the earlier steps in the proceeding, the factual basis to the plea agreement, which also addresses Ms. Castillo as one of the individual investors that put their money with the defendant and sustained a loss. And it even uses the term vulnerable in that context. Where I think the shift changed, the situation changed, Judge Rovner, was with regard to the PSR, because when the probation did its pre-sentence investigation report, it affirmed that the enhancement should apply, and it noted Dawn Weston, the principal victim's mother, as providing the basis for that. And so, again, without any objection from the defendant in his sentencing submission, as well as the government's focus on her, not Grace Castillo, that continued on into the sentencing hearing. But I would point out, Judge, that Grace Castillo made an unsworn statement at the sentencing hearing where she confirmed some of the statements that she had submitted to probation in a victim impact statement, and again highlighted for the court the fact that she was in a vulnerable state following the death of her husband with young children, and the fact that the defendant took advantage of that situation and stole over $400,000 in the process. I'm sorry, Your Honor, was there a follow-up? Okay. Going back to the procedure for a moment, I did want to talk a little bit about the Larinetta opinion, and I think it's important that we distinguish the factual setting from that case as to the one here. In that case, this court was considering whether to permit victims to intervene at the appellate level in a situation where their financial stake in a substantial restitution order would potentially be jeopardized in the matter being addressed on appeal. And it was in that context that this court juxtaposed the concerns about intervention, not mere participation or being reasonably heard, but an actual intervention at the district court level. And that's where that language comes from that the defendant just cited. That's not what happened here. The defendants, the victims were afforded an opportunity to be heard. They were offered that opportunity both in person at sentencing as well as through their counsel. And they submitted matters in writing prior to the hearing, and the defendant had an ample opportunity to respond to those matters.
Well, before, what should we do with this mortgage mess?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Judge. I think some context there is helpful as well. First, I would point out that the pleading that the defendant has filed in this matter was made more than 2 months after the sentencing hearing. So it's somewhat challenging to understand how Judge Wood would have considered that. But insofar as whether or not it illustrates an inconsistency in the positions that the victim's counsel took, the victim's counsel stated at sentencing that the defendant had quote, never paid a dime with respect to that mortgage. Whereas months later, in a verified pleading, he indicated that there was a $1 million payment. But I think, again, additional context is helpful. As noted in the pleading that the defendant filed in his reply brief, there were a number of other mortgages that were filed against with respect to that property that brought the value way from the original $2.6 million to north of $4 million. In addition, there was an allegation that the defendant forged a release in 2012 with respect to that same secured interest, that same home. That's never been denied. That's never been denied by the defendant at the trial level. It's not been denied here at the appellate level. So, but I think the key for this court's consideration is whether or not that was inaccurate. And even if it is inaccurate, did the district court rely on it? And the record is clear in this case that though the district court considered the submission from the victim's counsel and appreciated it and thanked them for providing that context, the district court did not rely on that information in rendering its below guideline sentence for the defendant. So if there's no further questions, I see I'm out of time. The government requests that this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Fleur. Mr. Gerling.
Several things, Your Honor. There's a lot to unpack on the due process issue, but I'm going to try and bundle all together with this thought. And the mortgage mess is more than a mortgage mess. It was a more than $1 million lie that was told. It extended the crime back 2 years, and I don't think you can say the court considered it and was thankful for it and found it helpful, but then ignored it. I think it's clear that the court, and a lot of times you go through the transcript, a lot of time there's a lot of back and forth, not just about the mortgage, but also speculation about whether or not Mr. Issa's has money overseas somewhere. And while the government says our investigation didn't show that was true, the government also says, well, we can't foreclose that possibility. We don't know that didn't happen. And again, that invites the court to engage in speculation. But I'd like Gerling, just to,
yes. Could I ask you a question? The district judge here, as noted, gave a below guideline sentence and in the guideline calculations gave Mr. Issa credit for acceptance of responsibility. It seems to me it would be very hard to reconcile reliance upon some of the facts you're focusing on, or the allegations you're focusing on, to have relied on that in making a decision on the sentence and still have given him acceptance and below guidelines. Can you help me with that?
Yes, Your Honor. Several things. First of all, the mortgage issue, which I do believe is a clear due process violation because it is clearly false information that it affected Mr. Issa's sentencing hearing. That occurred years before Mr. Issa began cooperating with the government. So the judge could believe that, credit it, It could impact her sentence, and she could still give Ms. Teresa acceptance of responsibility because that occurred, his cooperation, his acceptance occurred after. It would be like saying that you couldn't give him acceptance because he stole from some money from Mr. Weston in 2012. It doesn't matter. It all occurred before he began cooperating and providing information. I think it's also very difficult to sit here with and look at other facts, such as this idea, is there money somehow in an account overseas, and say the judge didn't consider it at all because she gave him acceptance. She may have felt, well, there's not enough to give to for me to deny him acceptance, but it certainly could have affected her thinking about Mr. Issa and how she was going to sentence him. Yes, it's below guidelines. That doesn't actually matter under the law, but he received a very stiff sentence of 16 years, which is above what people normally receive in similar financial crimes. I see I'm over my time. Could I have another minute just to address the vulnerable victim issue?
Absolutely, you may take it 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll take the 2 minutes then. Because the one point that I did want to make with regard to the due process issue is, just imagine for a second if the shoe was on the other foot. And this, Your Honor, is why I made what you called my presumptuous comment at the beginning. But imagine if a third party came in to a sentencing hearing and started making allegations that the government was unaware of, that they couldn't fight, that was unsupported, that argued for a more lenient sentence. The government would be apoplectic. They'd be beside themselves. They wouldn't allow it to happen. And I understand Mr. Fuller saying, well, defense counsel didn't object. Well, they did object. They objected very tiptoeedly because they were essentially put in the untenable position of having to call the victim a liar while trying to get acceptance of responsibility. So the defense attorney did object. He said, these things aren't true. Judge, he doesn't have a discovery obligation, but he was in that impossible situation. And that's why I believe the parties, the government and the defense bar and the prosecution, have a common interest in assuring, as the court said in Larinetta, the proper flow of information and the proper control over the flow of information in a case like this, so that defendants do receive due process of the law. With regard to the vulnerable victim issue, just to respond to Judge Rovner's question, you know, our issue with that is very, very narrow, and it's simply that, and I understand there's no targeting requirement anymore, but if you look at the commentary, and you're supposed to interpret the guidelines to give the commentary meaning, if you look at the commentary, the examples of when that enhancement would apply are examples such as marketing a cancer cure to cancer victims or targeting someone in a robbery because they're handicapped. It's not our case. And the instance that describes where it would not apply, a mass marketing to the general public, and it happens to be that one of those individuals, maybe like Miss Weston, is vulnerable, is mentally infirm, that does seem to really be more of our case, because based upon the record, and you know, I was not involved in the underlying case or investigation, but based upon the appellate record, it seems very clear that Mr. Issa was targeting Roger Weston and the banks that had control of dozens of accounts. I think 31 was the number in the record. And all of his communications were with Mr. Weston, with the bank. There's no indication that he had any direct communication or directed anything or said anything to Don Weston. So while I appreciate that in his plea agreement, he said, yes, she was mentally infirm, there is no indication that he tried to target or exploit or communicate with her or direct anything to her or do anything that would have resulted in him taking advantage of her in any way. She had really nothing to do with his ability to embezzle that money.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Gerland. Thank you very much, Mr. Fleur. And
thank you.
This will be taken under advisement.